My name is Chris Bell, and today's date is September the 1st, 1982. And I'm speaking with Captain Ellis at his home. It's on Mount Tolmie, isn't it?
Mount Tolmie, it is.
Yes, sir. Well, perhaps you could start or begin by telling me when and where you were born.
I was born on the 15th of October, 1900, in a small village in the New Forest in England called Exbury, E-X-B-U-R-Y.
What did your father do, sir?
My father was a padre.
Was he?
In the Church of England.
And he had a small, was he a vicar, vicarage?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, how did you get from there to Canada?
Well, that goes back a long way. I had a friend at school and university, Richard Law, son of Bonner Law, who was one time Prime Minister.
Leader of the Conservative Party.
For a short time, yes. Yeah. And,
may I close the door, sir?
Oh, yes.
And he was your friend, wasn't he?
He was my friend. He came out to Canada on a tour. There was an election going on, and he traveled with Arthur Mynn, I think, from East Coast to West Coast. And was so struck by Canada that he decided that we both ought to come out here and make our living in this vast country.
Well, what year did he come and visit Canada?
That would have been...
Was it before or after the First War?
After. In the 1920s. And so we did come out together and we went to Alberta. With the idea of farming.
Had you done any farming before that?
No. But Dick's father then had recently died, and he was very anxious to write his biography. Mm-hmm. So he left me in Canada to... the idea was we would buy a ranch together, and I would run the ranch. Well, he came visiting celebrity.
Did he actually write the biography of his father?
No, he didn't. Someone else did. I've forgotten whom. Anyway, that was what I left in Canada.
Before, let's head back a little bit. So what about your education?
Education, it was a typical sort of English education. At the age of 8, I went to a private boarding school.
Mm-hmm. Which one and where?
A school called Lipbrook in Hampshire.
Was it a good school?
Highfield School. Yes, very good school, very well run. And from there I went to what we call a public school in England, which means a senior private school. And that school was Shrewsbury up in the Midlands.
It's quite a good school, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And from there I went to Oxford.
Did you take a degree?
Yes, I took. Not as good a degree as I should have done, because I was preoccupied with rowing at that time.
What did you take your degree in?
I took an honors degree in history. Mm-hmm. But only a third class, I regret to say.
Well, according to Evelyn Waugh, if you don't get either a first or a fourth, you've wasted your time at Oxford. Because a first would have meant that you would have studied quite hard, and a fourth would have meant you would have been playing rugby and drinking all night, I think.
Yeah. Well, they say the second is the marker of the mediocrity.
Is it? I hope not, because that's what I'm getting. How did you find Oxford then? Because this would have been about 1918?
Yes, immediately after the war, and which was extremely interesting because about 50% of the undergraduates had come back from fighting the war, mm-hmm. and the other 50% were fresh out of school, like me.
And were these people that came back after the war mainly of the officer class, or was there some sort of program in Britain that allowed other men to come up to Oxford and Cambridge?
There was, to this extent, that they put on special short courses for people who had been fighting the war, so they could get a degree in 2 years, if I remember rightly.
Really?
Yeah.
Must have been very intensive.
Yes, I think. It would be a pass degree anyway, it wouldn't be an honors degree.
And you rode, did you?
Yes, I rode for 2 years in the Oxford crew.
On the 8th?
Yes.
Did you, What is the famous Henley? Did you row at that regatta?
As a schoolboy, yes. Mm-hmm.
Any fond...
Yeah, Shrewsbury was just becoming then quite a good rowing school.
At the various levels of your education, do you remember anything much about discipline? Was there a great deal of corporal punishment? Because from the image I have, it was a lot of a headmaster who would instill a large degree of discipline with his cane.
Yes.
A great deal of fear.
So that was the accepted thing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you left your mother's arms and went to school, you expected to be beaten.
It was
periodically.
Even if you were good.
Well, you could avoid it by being very careful, but not easy.
Become a swat, I suppose.
Yes.
I think that's the right word of it.
And then when I went to Shrewsbury, it was not so much the teaching staff as the senior boys who wielded a weapon.
Yeah.
Make them conform to what they thought was the right way of life.
Tell me a little bit about Oxford then. What college did you go to?
I went to a college called Keble, which is one of the newer colleges, newest almost. It was founded about 1860 or thereabouts. And it was red brick instead of being stone. It was originally founded for the sons of clergy, or people who were going to go into the church. There was a very ecclesiastical atmosphere about it.
And was it your intention, or at least your father's intention, that you would follow in his footsteps?
Not necessarily, I think, no.
Were you the only... how many children were in your family?
There were 8 boys and 1 girl.
God, that's quite a crew.
Yes.
And where did you fit in amongst that, chronologically? Were you the eldest?
I was 4 in life. I had 2 elder brothers, both killed in the First World War. And then my sister, and then myself, and then a string of other twin-nosed boys.
How did that set you up then? What plans were made for you, for your future?
Because well, the normal thing was to go to a preparatory boarding school, and then to a public school. And in our case, it was the school was decided by where you could get a scholarship, obviously, because so my father must have a bit of money to try and educate 8 boys all at once. It's quite something.
Yeah. He could have married off the daughter, I suppose, to a rich... Well, I guess that
could have worked. No, it didn't work that
way. No.
So, we went to a variety of schools between us.
Was there any thought, or did you give any thought... you were born in 1900, which would have meant that the war would have ended when you were 18.
Yeah.
Any thought to trying to join up when you were quite young, or did your father block this?
To join, you mean before I was called up? No. Having had 2 brothers killed already,
so any romantic notions about the war would have been washed out of your eyes by that time?
Of course, I thought... from 1917 onwards, that my destiny was to join the army, but actually I was called up, but I was excused because I had been in the officers' training corps at school, so that gave an extra 6 months of leeway. It was just in time for the war to end. As far as I was concerned, it was lucky. So I was disappointed at the time.
But in retrospect...
That's why I joined up in the Second World War.
Okay, so you get your degree in Oxford, and you come to Canada shortly thereafter, I guess.
Yes.
How did you find Alberta? It must have been a marked change from Oxford.
Yes, that was a very fascinating country, though. And...
whereabouts in Alberta did you land? Or, I shouldn't say land, but where did you end up?
Calgary, to begin with. In Calgary district. And as soon as I'd been there for 1 summer, working at odd jobs on various farms, I went to a farm school at Olds in Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
And there I took a short course in farming.
What did that entail?
It really entailed a very good general course and crops and rotation of crops, animal husbandry, practically everything, like even blacksmithing. So it's really bad.
Was it what you had expected to do? Or had you expected...
Well, I thought if I was going to farm, I might as well try and find out what farming was all about.
But you hadn't had this image of the gentleman farmer wearing a tweed jacket and suit.
Well, no, that disappeared very quickly.
So how long did you last in Alberta as a farmer?
I lasted through till the spring, because I think the course started in October, and in March it finished, because all the pupils had to get back to the spring sowing, and I decided to that there was no future for farming unless I had an income, which I didn't have, or could raise some capital, which I couldn't do. So I decided to trek on out to British Columbia and see what I could do out here.
And this would have been about 1923?
24? No, it was 26, 27. Because after I left Oxford, I taught at Westminster School in London for 3 or 4 years.
Did you enjoy that? Did you enjoy teaching?
I always enjoyed teaching, yes.
What did you teach? Was it to younger boys, Westminster School?
Yes, to the junior boys. Latin, English.
Is that a school affiliated with, is it right in, it's near St. Paul's, isn't it?
No, it's Westminster Abbey, right in the shadow of the Abbey. St. Paul's has a school attached to it, yes. There's nowhere near St. Paul's Cathedral, but Westminster School
was right near Westminster Abbey.
Situated, yes. If you happen to know the Abbey, and the cloisters go around the south side, and then there's a place called Dean's Yard, which is occupied by the school buildings. Most primitive old buildings, but lots of history attached to it.
Oh, it's a fascinating bit of London.
Yes.
I can remember being there about a year and a half ago and being fascinated by it.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're there for about 2-3 years?
4 years altogether, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was chiefly hired to be a rowing coach. Rather than to be an intellectual.
I guess that was important in those days, wasn't it, rowing?
Yes.
Yeah. Had you given any thought to teaching in Canada?
Well, as soon as I decided that farming was not for me, the only other alternative I had was teaching. And
such that you left about 1926 for Britain. Was it before or after the general strike?
Just before. I missed out on the general strike.
What side would you have taken up? Would you have been in support of the strikers or against?
Probably against, I think, with all my traditional background, having school and university and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. But you came up to Alberta and you made your way to BC.
Yes.
Did you go to Vancouver or Victoria?
I went straight to Victoria because I wanted to go to Comox because I used to be sent from England the English newspaper called The Field, and one article in The Field extolled the glories and excellence of Comox. So I thought this would be a place I might go, and if things didn't work out I might I worked for a while on farms there and look over the situation. It so happened that one of the first people I ran into on Vancouver Island was Lonsdale, who was the headmaster and founder of Shawinigan Lake School. And he had also been at Westminster as a boy.
Did you know him?
I had quite an in with him.
Did you know him at all, or was it just sort of a mutual...
I had never met him before I came out here.
He was a bit older than you.
But, yes. So when
you had common ground.
Yes, so indeed, yes.
So you went to work for him at Shawinigan Lake?
I worked at Shawinigan Lake, yes.
You weren't married at this point, were you?
No.
No, you're a single man.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to Comox Valley at that time?
I did, yes. I went out there and there I found a man called Dusty Dastere, who had actually been at the same preparatory school. And he sort of introduced me around the district there.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time my father was interested in retiring, and he thought he might retire out to Comox,
mm-hmm.
which he did, in fact. He retired and came out here and built himself a house in the village of Comox.
Is it still standing?
I think it is, but it's impossible to find it nowadays because in those days it was a solitary house in a field below St. James's Hospital, right on the water's edge. And now I can't even find the field there.
Probably doesn't exist anymore.
No.
No. How large a school was Shawnigan Lake School?
It had just recovered from a fire. And the new building had just been put up. And I suppose there would be about 80 boys when I first went there.
Mm-hmm. What ages? What level are you teaching? Young boys again?
The ages went all the way from about 7 to 18,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was too much of a mix, really.
And were you teaching the whole range?
I was teaching the more senior people then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I have the patience or aptitude for teaching really small boys.
No. I would think it would be much easier teaching smaller boys than older boys, because in that age bracket they tend to feel a little bit more sure of themselves, and
yes,
and they tend to be a bit more loose in class. Need a bit more discipline, I should think.
Yes, I've always found it easier myself to teach senior people,
mm-hmm.
more senior people.
The level of maturity, you think?
Hmm?
The level of maturity?
Yes, yes.
How long did you teach there?
I taught there until 1932. And then I went to take over the headmastership of Brentwood College. And that was a disastrous time to take over anything.
Because of the Depression?
Because the first thing people started to economize in was education for their children.
Mm-hmm. The private school,
yes.
Went the way of the public,
yes,
public school.
Down,
So what happened at Brentwood School?
Well, we struggled. It didn't fold together, no. There was one time when we were down to about 24 boys.
Ooh.
But then graduates started to climb out again, and after the war, we were doing all right. We got up to about 50, 60 pupils, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war came along, it mushroomed still more, actually, but I was back by then.
I think you once mentioned to me earlier, well, when I saw you last time, that you had been in the Supplementary Reserve.
Yes.
Was that part of the Royal Canadian Naval Volunteer Reserve?
Yes, it was a sort of subsidiary part.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to get hold of people who had some sort of nautical knowledge.
And you had some? I suppose rowing?
Yes, I had done some sailing in England, and so around about Southampton, Isle of Wight, or that part of the world, because that's where we lived,
mm-hmm.
that I was growing up. And so we did short courses and piloted gunnery and whatnot down at Scrambles.
Mm-hmm. When did you join the Supplementary Reserve?
1938, I think.
What just spurred you to do that?
Just before Munich. Well, obviously it was going to be a war, so.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And were you quite aware of what was going on in Europe at the time?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think so.
And was it general knowledge in Victoria, at least amongst your circle, that Hitler was heading towards war and that it was inevitable? That
certainly by 1938, yes.
Mm-hmm.
With Munich and all that sort of stuff going on.
What was the Supplementary Reserve like in Victoria?
It was a small band of brothers. It was organized by, at that time, Lieutenant Commander Edwards, who thought that we must be more prepared than we seem to be, and that he formed the supplementary reserve, and also he was, I think, he had something to do with the fisherman's reserve too, getting a lot of the trawlers and other fishermen in the area interested in shooting up German little jacks. They were a wild lot.
What would they have done? Put machine guns on top of trawlers?
That's about all they had. They had a burst gun or a machine gun, and they were told to make sure that the Japanese were behaving themselves.
When you say the Japanese, you mean the Japanese on the coast?
Yes.
What sort of orders were given for that? Just to keep an eye on them? Were they seen as being separate and distinct from Canadians? The Japanese?
I think so, yes.
What are your feelings about that? About the internment of the Japanese and our treatment of
them? I think a great deal too much fuss has been made of this. Because I must reflect on how the way the Japanese treated our people who...
Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And the British of Singapore.
It was tough, I'm sure, and the Japanese losing everything. And maybe they could have had more compensation for the boats and living in the houses they lost. They got none, I suppose.
But it was motivated by a genuine feeling of fear on most people's part. And
see, there were a great number of them.
Yeah.
And they were intimate with the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And they did pose, I think, something of a threat.
Mm-hmm. Because only a small percentage of them had been born in Canada and were legally Canadian citizens.
Yes.
I think a great majority of them, in fact, were Japanese nationals living in Canada.
I think they were, yes.
It's a shame that so much attention is focused upon it and not on other things that happened in China, say, in the 1930s. I think it would color people's opinions of that, what happened slightly differently than they view it now.
Yes.
Yeah. But it is sort of a civil rights question, and we in North America tend to key on things like that, whether it's Japanese or blacks.
Yeah.
Yeah. What sort of training did you do at Supplementary Reserve? Aside from tying knots, would you go out sailing, or were there ships you could train upon?
There were a couple of minesweepers which we could do then some navigation and pilotage.
What kind of minesweepers? Were they old World War I vintage boats?
Yes.
On the active rolls of the RCS?
They were still active, yes. They're pretty antique. I think.
But it gave you a thorough grounding in seamanship, I suppose.
Yes.
Would you go out on, say, a fortnight trip?
Oh, no, nothing as long as that. We just about day trips, because most of us had jobs to do as well as...
Mm-hmm.
And we got no pay for being in Supplementary Reserve. Ready to muster when the war broke out, form a nucleus of people who could be trained further.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I say, all we did was very elementary courses in pilotage, seamanship, gunnery, torpedo.
So there was nothing like anti-submarine tactics or...
Anti-submarine was almost unknown.
And I suppose even if you wanted to learn, we didn't have any submarines to use anyway to practice.
They had
on.
No submarines to practice on.
Lots of
and there was no Arctic gear too. Some of the first ships were just being fitted with that in 1939.
Mm-hmm. And it was still somewhat secretive, wasn't it? And I guess the British weren't really too keen upon having their Canadian brothers in our rather antiquated ships using something as forward
secretly, yes, because as it was kept secret for a reasonable length of time, I think.
Yeah. When were you called out? Mobilized?
In September of 1939.
Was the following Canada's declaration of war before?
Following. I think the declaration of war opened the gates so that we were allowed in and able to put on a uniform and get going.
Were the uniforms put on?
No, but they didn't get uniforms then.
I didn't think so because we didn't have much of a backlog of equipment, I don't think.
No. Having J. Wilson, I think, did their best.
What did you end up wearing for your first parade?
I think probably grey flannel trousers and a blue blazer with a maple leaf on the pocket. Very smart.
very becoming, I think. What did you do when you were all gathered together? And where were you gathered together? Out of the Esquimalt?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, almost immediately, we were sent off to do various jobs which were very unfitted. For example, I was sent, as soon as I could raise a uniform, I worked in the examination vessel off William Head. This was a fishery patrol boat converted into the naval use, called Malaspina, an Latin boat ship. And when I left her, I went into a ship called France Peur, which had been the Duke of Sutherland's very palatial yacht. And she was being used for patrol purposes. We went round the island and
We sent an examination vessel, the Malaspina. What did that mean?
It means all vessels coming in up straight to Juan de Fuca were stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And their papers were examined and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
See whether they were legitimate traders or whether there was any contraband on board.
And were you given any sort of rank? Or were you a seaman?
Yes, I was a temporary acting lieutenant of the NVR.
You can't get much.
The lowest of the low.
Was this, you said it's a temporary rank, did it?
Well, because everyone had joined up for wartime.
And temporary
men joined the colony during the existence of hostilities.
Mm-hmm. Was that soon to be dropped, the temporary?
I think on the Navy list it appeared all the time.
Did it?
During the war, yes. But people who had joined for the war.
How long were you on the Malaspina?
Let's see, I joined her in September, sometime in September, and I think till January, then I transferred to Saint-Pierre.
Tell me a bit about the Saint-Pierre. You said it was a palatial luxury yacht.
Yes.
What was your quarters like? Did it have a
she happened to be cruising in these waters, and when war broke out, she had held it for the Esquimalt as a safe place to be in, and was then taken over by the RCN. Do you know that book of all the Canadian vessels?
That big, I think I have seen it. Is there photographs of it inside?
This one. Ships are these.
Is the Saint-Pierre in here?
She is there, yes. If you look out in the bin, there's at the back.
How do you spell it?
Yes, it is Saint-Pierre. Saint-Pierre. It's on the approach.
I bet in its civilian colors it had very nice lines.
Oh, she was a beautiful vessel, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She had a sister ship over in England, which I also served in briefly.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather amusing that all the other officers were Royal Canadian Naval Reserve, that means they were professional seamen.
Professional amateur seamen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I was the only one who wasn't a professional, so they made me the navigating officer.
Had you had any?
Yes, that was rather amusing.
You had no training before navigation?
I had training in pilotage, but I had never taken a star sight or any sextant work.
So I guess you ran aground a few times, ran into a few ships.
Fortunately, the captain was a very cautious fellow, anyway.
What
it was in that ship that I first came across an Aztec set.
Mm-hmm. And that was installed upon the ship?
Yes, it was being installed when I joined her.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a professional Aztec officer by the end of the war.
You did?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And your first experience was on the coast?
It was in the Sons Pavilion.
How How long were you on the Sanskrit?
I stayed in there not all that long, only about 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was sent over to Halifax because I wanted some officers to take charge of the new entry divisions, which were now pouring into Stadacona and Halifax.
Mm-hmm.
Raised knots, and they needed some. And Edwards was looking after these new entries. He'd been transferred to the East Coast, and he wanted me. We asked for me to go over there,
yeah.
And so I joined that way. Stadacona. That's been in April of 1940.
Tell me, I know this might be rather difficult, but how did you find the differences between the two coasts? Say the degree of tension and the degree of war readiness. The feeling in the air between the Esquimalt and Halifax.
Oh yes, well, I think everybody recognized really that the war was going on the East Coast, yes.
And it was much more tense, I suppose.
Yes, because you could sit in Halifax and see the convoys sailing out of Bedford Basin,
mm-hmm.
and the escorts going out with them and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Right here, on the West Coast, there's nothing much to do except patrols round the island.
Yeah. With no hope of really seeing anything or finding anything to...
Not really.
Yeah. So you go to the East Coast, to Halifax, and you're working under your friend, Edwards?
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
what is your job? You say you're forming...
My job was a divisional officer for the new entry division.
Mm-hmm. Which
I say I had the division of about 30 or 40 men whose welfare I was supposed to look after and whose training I was supposed to supervise.
Mm-hmm.
We had a professional leading seaman for each division.
Mm-hmm.
They were about the most senior ratings that we had.
Were you still temporary acting?
Still temporary acting with talent.
So in effect you were something like a drill sergeant. You were a drill instructor. You had to train these men, get them in some sort of shape to be molded into seamen.
Right, yes. And at the same time, we had to go on taking courses ourselves because we were only just one jump ahead.
In other words, you're doing two jobs at once.
Yes.
Teaching
yes.
and being taught.
Teaching and being taught. Yes.
Was it sort of a 6 o'clock till midnight shift?
Yes, and doing duty ops in the barracks to 70 nights a week.
Mm-hmm. Did you mind doing this sort of training, or did you think that it was needed and that it had to be done?
Oh, obviously, yes, it had to be done, because ships were being built and they've got to have people ready to man them.
Mm-hmm. Had the corvette program been put into effect by this time?
It was, yes. The first corvettes that came down the river, I think, were in about July of 1940,
mm-hmm.
which was really pretty quick work.
Oh, it was, really. There have been some existing designs and some existing prototypes, I think, in Britain.
Yes, that's right, yes. Mm-hmm.
So you get there in April, which is before the final German onslaught in France.
Yes.
How did that strike you, Dunkirk, in June 1940?
I'm not sure.
How did you react to it? You're not sure how you reacted to it?
I think we were horrified and thought that the British Expeditionary Force was no more,
mm-hmm.
but it just made it more important to
feel
the war with no foolishness.
Yeah.
You remember it started with the phony war, which no one knew really whether there was going to be fighting or not.
Mm-hmm.
But Dunkirk left no one in any doubt.
Just it was a real war.
What was going on.
How long were you training this division? How long were you
I should think I did that for about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was appointed to the ASIC school, which was running in Halifax.
This
would have
been, say, in late 1940.
1940. And in early 1941, in January, I was sent overseas to the first long anti-submarine course for reserve officers. I was the only Canadian on that course. RNDR chaps.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that after the ASDIC training course in Halifax, that made you a Canadian expert on ASDIC. Was the thought that you would go to Britain for this training and become an instructor after that?
Yes, I think so.
Quite a bit in that manner.
Yes, I was sent over there because I'd been a schoolmaster, and it was assumed therefore that I should be confident to take this course and get some benefit out of it. Actually, I had been no knowledge of electronics at all.
So, and was it highly technical, the course?
Yes, very technical. The actual locale of HMS Osprey, which was the anti-submarine school, was this time in Glasgow, outside Glasgow, on the Clyde. And bitterly cold. We arrived there in January, and we were quartered in a summer hotel, which had no central heating above the lounge. They wanted to go in studying at night, but had put on three sweaters and a greatcoat, get into bed, and hope that the fingers wouldn't freeze. But it was good value.
Well, how long was the course in duration?
The course took from January to July.
It's a long course then?
Mm-hmm. For wartime days, yes. In pre-war days, it was a whole year. They fetched it out a whole year, but now it was concertinaed into 6 months.
Mm-hmm. And did this run the gamut of all anti-submarine techniques?
Yes.
Including ASDIC?
Every time of ASDIC set.
Sonar as well, or was sonar just still in the drawing board?
ASDIC and sonar were the same thing, except the sonar was the American name for what they produced. And ASDIC was...
So it's radar perhaps I'm thinking of then.
Oh, yes.
The radar and anti-submarine.
Well, no, we didn't take in radar, except insofar as it affected anti-submarine tactics. But all echo sounders and every type of ASDIC set we were supposed to be familiar with.
Mm-hmm. So what happened in July 1941? Did you head back to Canada?
I was sent back to Canada then. In a whale factory ship. In the convoy we were sailing west in and had some spare accommodation. And smelt like whale factory ship too.
Could they not find any other accommodation for you? Because heck, there should have been some
spare. Well, they found it. I was given a beautiful ticket for the command line. And I expected we would be traveling in a luxurious manner.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were painted out in this dirty old pocket. However, it was nice to get home anyway, whatever ship we traveled in.
Which you did, and were you assigned to the training school?
No, I was then sent out to Newfoundland, to the Newfoundland Escort Force, to act as an AS or staff officer to the senior officer of an escort group. Well, that would have been all right, but senior officership was so crowded already with officers that he said he couldn't possibly make room for any more. But if I could find a billet in any other ship in his group, he'd be very happy to know I was there.
Wouldn't they be screaming for someone as well-trained as you were in anti-submarine tactics?
Well, see, this was a destroyer. It still hadn't got down to the fact that anti-submarine was the most important thing we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Because if I remember correctly, Canadians were going as far as Iceland. Or
yes.
And they weren't really running into too much U-boat traffic at that time, were they?
No.
They were mostly centered around the British Isle, I suppose, British Isle.
Yes, they were gradually starting to move westward, the U-boats, I mean, in 41, 1942, those Hubers and the Gulf St. Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
But I found my birth in a corvette called Collingwood. A friend of mine was the first lieutenant. He said, well, they had to have another watchkeeper on board. But in those days, the corvette had a commanding officer, first lieutenant, a navigating officer, and a sub-lieutenant or another junior boy, and that was it.
And so you
four
were...
officers. So I became useful to them as a watchkeeper.
Is anything else just a watchkeeper?
Well, in charge of the ASIC, too.
Was it, I guess it was a flower class corvette, wasn't
flower
it?
Class, yes.
How did you find them? Well, you, I suppose you had good sea legs at the time.
I thought they were magnificent seabirds,
yeah.
But very lively. As you thought you'd never get drowned in one of those, anyway.
The thing could turn and spin and
yes.
Never keel over. Were you ever seasick in
them? One.
First time out?
First time we left St. John, there was a heavy swell immediately outside, and I parted with my breakfast, and after that I said, all right, and worried me again.
Mm-hmm. What were officers quartered like on the flower class corvette?
Adequate, I think. There were, commanding officer had his own cabin, and there were two cabins between the other three officers.
So the first officer would get known.
But there's no room for me there, so I... I sang a hammock right aft in the little sort of torpedo flat, right aft in the corvette. And there was room there to sing a hammock and dump my gear.
Mm-hmm.
It was a long walk up to the bridge. When you're trying to hang on at night and find your way.
Do the caps and the other officers have bunks, or do they have...
Yes.
I would think that a hammock would actually be a...
Hammock was very better because it
would swim
wouldn't get
boat.
Thrown out so much, yes.
Yeah. How about food on a corvette?
Getting in was...
yeah. What was food like on a corvette?
Pretty basic,
mm-hmm.
I think.
A lot of bangers and mash?
Red lettuce and bacon. And yes, that sort of thing.
Just something...
Bread for about 3 days, not for that. I think,
Just while it was still fresh.
Yes.
They couldn't bake on board a corvette, I guess.
I think they must have done, to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think about that. Yes, the only time that I was in a ship where we were reduced to eating a ship's biscuit was later on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because we were at sea for about 28 days at that time. And they ran out of flour, so we got down to these
hard
biscuits there.
Shades of mutiny on the bounty.
Yeah.
No yeah. Weevils
things
in the
don't change that in the Royal Navy.
No, they don't. How long were you on the Collingwood?
I stayed in the Collingwood until Christmas when she went into refit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was... the anti-submarine school put its finger on me again. And I was made one of the two sea training officers for the ASIC ratings.
And you found
that's
your...
in Margaret's Bay.
Mm-hmm. And where's that?
That's about 25 miles south of Halifax.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good large bay, a good sort of exercising in. We had a tame Dutch submarine to play with there.
Well, tell me, did you find that your spell on the Collingwood had given you some practical application of the theories you had learned?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed.
Had you run across any...
Actually, in Collingwood, we never saw a ship torpedo nor a U-boat.
And no soundings at all? No pings in the night?
Well, no. None that were genuine in U-boats, no. We were in the first group of corvettes that went over to Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
We did a trip to Ireland and back between the time I joined and the Christmas leave. And never has the Emerald Isle looked more emerald than after about Tainted Eyes at Sea.
Record that. What run were you making on in the Collingwood? Was it
normally leaving John for Iceland and back?
How many times did you make that?
I think we went to Iceland twice, and then over to Ireland once. So there were three trips in the course of the time I was on board.
How long?
Three round trips, let's say.
How long would you be on board ship for any one given time?
You mean at sea?
Yes, on board ship at sea.
Oh, I should say the average time would be about 15 to 18 days.
Mm-hmm. How did the men react to that confined living on board ship like that for that length of time?
I think they were remarkable that they survived at all, because the mess deck absolute hell.
And didn't they live in the mess as well, in the hammocks above the table?
That's right, yeah.
Dreadful conditions, I think, for the men.
They were appalling.
Yeah.
But the most of our deaths seemed to remain remarkably sane and remarkably cheerful.
Mm-hmm. Were a lot of them ex-merchant seamen, or were most of them prairie boys?
Nearly all of them were prairie boys, all from southern Ontario. Or never seen the ocean in their lives before.
But I take it they did see quite a bit of it afterwards.
Yeah.
How did the prairie boys react to the Navy on the whole?
Well, I think on the whole they thought they were the Navy. Quite rightly too.
Tell me about this training. What bay was it? Was the Dutch submarine?
St. Margaret's Bay.
St. Margaret's Bay.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of submarine was it? Diesel?
Yes, it was a reasonably modern submarine.
Mm-hmm.
It was one that had escaped from Holland when the Nazis took over. And she was lent to us for purposes of training and gave the crew a pleasant spell and a place where they could come ashore and see some lights and that sort of thing.
Were you given a corvette to work from, or some other ship?
We had a corvette and a Bangor minesweeper attached to the school for purposes of taking the training classes on board, taking them out to sea and hunting the submarine,
mm-hmm.
and then returning them to store about 3 days later. And there were two of us